Welcome to the second episode of the Daniels Radio Podcast. This episode's theme is Women in Design, highlighting narratives of the intersectional female experience at Daniels and more broadly in the field of design. I think for me, one of the first things that came to mind when I decided to be part of this podcast was addressing the simplistic view of gender inherent in the name Women in Design. This name neglects to address a wide range of gender-based issues, such as the experience of trans and genderqueer folk. I believe that feminism must always strive to be intersectional in nature and must include a wide variety of gender identities as well as address the intersection of gender with other equity issues such as race and class. Our podcast today will include four segments by four student groups from within the Daniels faculty. We will start off with a mini segment from Project Get Home Safe, a student design group that I'm a part of, who's working on addressing the gendered issues of night safety through community-informed practices. Next, we will hear from Making a Difference, a Daniels-based student club that is working to create a community and provide a safe space for women and non-binary folk to have conversations about how gender affects their experience in the architecture and arts fields. The next segment was created by two Masters of Landscape students, Louisa Kennett and Allison Smith, which features an interview with a recent graduate from the Masters program in which they discuss their experience at Daniels, female designers who inspire them, and their experience working in the field. The final segment is a roundtable discussion between four former and current students of the master's program, structured around five critical questions about their intersectional experiences with the academic and professional environment. I'm really excited about the variety of voices we have on this episode today and can't wait to get this conversation started. My name is Aisling Beers, and I use she, her pronouns.
Hi, I'm Xavier Fox, and I go by he, him.
Hi, I'm Maya. I use she, her pronouns. We are all undergraduate students studying architecture at the Daniels faculty, specializing in design, and together we make up Project Get Home Safe.
We're working in collaboration on a project for Reza Nick in his class Guided Distractions 3 to explore through experimentation safety of women, trans, and gender non-binary folk in the context of the urban night. Particularly, we are focused on the act of walking. I'm also using these experiments to fuel my research for my undergraduate thesis on the same topic.
Our research was in part inspired by the incidents of gender-based violence that occurred this summer in Toronto, predominantly in the West End. We acknowledge that these issues of night safety are acts of femicide, and our response has been focused on centering the voices of feminized people in order to accurately inform our design solutions.
Our response has been inspired as well by another outcome of this summer, being the informal typologies of street-side patios that have emerged as a dining solution to the COVID-19 pandemic. Our main objective is to increase feelings of safety in the urban residential environment, allowing marginalized individuals a greater right to the city. If you want to take a look into the incidents this summer, I'd recommend the TO West End Community Forum on Instagram. We've concentrated much of our efforts exploring the residential neighborhoods, which, as a result of zoning bylaws, lack much commercial opportunity. Because of this, these neighborhoods become isolating at night and effectively materialize as dead zones with limited human activity, especially throughout the pandemic. Through the personal experience of my friends and peers and participant feedback, we found that this lack of human presence makes these spaces most threatening.
In my thesis, I have been focusing on creating safer networks in these residential fabrics and have explored the reintroduction of former corner commercial spaces as a way to bring passive surveillance and activity to these areas. In the experiments with Maya and Xavier, we have been exploring guerrilla interventions to replicate what an influx of people may do for these spaces. Through these experiments, we have focused on using community-based research to address these issues in the experiences of women and genderqueer folk. We believe that centering the voices of those who have firsthand experience is the best way to create community-based solutions. This is really what we see as the future of design practices. In any designed intervention, the primary concern should be listening to and accurately addressing and respecting the individuals the space will serve. Design should be focused on serving the needs of people, especially those who have been marginalized in our society, and not just for aesthetic purposes.
The audio piece we are about to share with you came from an open call submission we put on our Instagrams, asking for voice recordings from women, trans, and non-binary folk to share their answer to the question we posed. What comes to mind when you think about walking alone at night? While we were thrilled by the numbers of responses we got from our community who were willing to share their thoughts and stories with us, it also reinforced the importance of having these conversations amongst each other, as it became so apparent how many of us have and continue to experience similar feelings when alone at night. We hope that through further sharing this sound piece, we will continue to expand this conversation within your homes and amongst your community.
When I think of walking,
when I think about walking alone at night,
not do it. Avoid walking alone at night at all costs. It's not safe.
Don't even consider it, really. If it's nighttime, stay inside.
I get
smaller
scared, I guess,
neighborhoods
when it's
or
like
non-main
in a quieter neighborhood
are quite poorly lit, and so the darkness also tends
normally
to contribute.
When I'm in residential areas, I walk in the middle of the roads because I find the sidewalks
I think
to be
it
too
was
scary.
But if I'm walking no downtown and there's people around, then it feels
I
a bit
present
safer.
More androgynously, and I feel
scared.
That I
on edge, like hyper aware
with a group or at least another person.
If I feel uncomfortable,
edge,
if
scared.
Someone feels too close, or if they,
I usually walk with a knife.
Been someone behind
fear
me for a long
takes
time.
Takes control
I
of
often
all
find
rational
that
thoughts.
I will think about whether
yeah,
I often
check behind
me to see if someone
always
is
looking behind my back. Always making a mental note, not making eye contact while people around you from the corner of your eye.
Keys between your fingers. Heavy
take
metal
all
water bottle
out
swung
and
really
looking
hard
all over the place.
No, walking with my huge over-the-ear ear headphones, and he mentioned how easy it would be to kidnap me while I'm wearing them and walking alone.
I was walking, snow was blowing into my
under
face.
The influence,
and all there were, it seemed, were men on the street. Basically at every corner. Highly inappropriate.
I've always thought that I was very, very paranoid, but I don't know if this is actually just how everyone who's a female acts at night.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Making Difference segment of this podcast. My name is Dahlia, and I will be the moderator. I am a fourth-year student at the University of Ottawa studying anthropology.
Hey, guys. I'm Tanvi. I'm a fourth-year student at Daniels in my undergrad, and I'm the treasurer of Making Difference.
Hi, everyone. I'm Miranda Omar. I'm in my fourth year at Daniels in the technology stream and architecture. And I'm one of the co-organizers and co-founders of Making Difference. So I'll tell you a little bit about the club. The club, Making Difference, aims to create a safe space for all those who identify as women and non-binary folks to discuss their experiences in the design fields. We're also actively creating a community and mentorship between peers and between students and professionals.
Hi, I'm Isabel. I'm the other co-organizer and co-founder of Making Difference. So our club is really founded on principles of intersectional feminism and equity, which is why we wanted to speak on this podcast today. So we have our exec team, which consists of four of us, and our general membership, but we really designed the club to have a non-hierarchical structure. So as an exec team, our job is really to facilitate kind of the discussions and also facilitate the work that gets done, not to act as these powerful figures, if that makes sense. And we also really were intentional with all of the language that we were using within our club to kind of mirror these ideas of equity and intersectional feminism.
With intersectional feminism being such a foundational element for the club, why don't we jump in there to start this conversation off and just how that plays a part in the club?
Yeah, so intersectional feminism, kind of at the very basic level, is understanding that there are multiple factors and identities that overlap when we're talking about feminism other than gender. So it's really taking into account racial experiences along with gendered experiences, class experiences, and kind of all of the isms that we think of when we're thinking of equity. So we really tried to instill that at every level of the club.
Great. So having talked about intersectional feminism and experiences and space, specifically, what led you to create this space? Why did you decide that this was something that you wanted to pursue?
We found that although we had been experiencing these things and, I mean, talking about them within friend groups, there wasn't really a way to kind of expose that this was a broader issue within Daniels and that other people were having these same experiences. So as we started to talk to more people, it became apparent that we needed somewhere to do this, especially now that we don't have that face-to-face interaction. So this is more to create a community of people that wouldn't necessarily have classes together or even bump into each other in the hallway in Daniels, but can come together and discuss these experiences to know that A, they're not alone, and B, that we could change these things.
Yeah, I think it was also a shock, the fact that this kind of space didn't already exist at Daniels. I mean, we realized it going into fourth year, but we're like, wait a second, how come this space doesn't already exist? And it does exist in other schools as well. It's also an interesting time, I think, to be creating such a space and talking about these issues, because I think we're in 2020 and you'd think that gender equality is like very present in this field and in other fields. And also being in Canada, I guess you would assume that it's all great and that there's not much to talk about. So I feel like while we sometimes talk about these things just with our friends and in regular conversations, there isn't that much conversation about it because it's still a bit taboo to talk about it. And I think we almost feel like we shouldn't. Like I know that I feel like if I were to say something about my experience, it would sound like I'm just whining or, you know, I'm excusing my lack of merit by saying that this is like a gender issue. So we end up kind of, I don't want to use a big word like gaslighting, but I think we end up reducing our own experiences because we'd rather have everything be okay. And it's easier to say that it's our own fault than say that, you know, we face discrimination, for example. Right. So yeah, it was very important to create such a space and just create discussion. And I think by kind of concretizing this club, we're saying, you know, these conversations are important. So I think even just for us as members and organizers and such, it was a very empowering experience in itself, and it continues to be. And the more people join us, I think that's also very empowering, because then you realize that you're not alone and you realize that this matters and that these conversations matter. So it's really about like revealing what's like the issues that have been there, but also I guess revealing and putting on the spotlight the work that is being done by amazing students, designers, who are women and who are non-binary.
Yeah, I think it's just really important to take up space in an institutional setting. Just because, yes, we can discuss this with our friends, and that's a way to make us feel better and to know that we're not alone in these situations, but in order to make change, it needs to be on the university's radar.
Yeah, and we talked a lot about experience at Daniels and as a student and as a woman and, you know, as people of color, for some of our members. So how have these experiences affected your outlook on what it means to be a woman in the architectural or art profession or field?
Yeah, I guess these discussions for me have really kind of illuminated the experiences that I'm having and why they're happening. I've worked for several summers now in a pretty male-dominated firm, and I mean, they're great guys, but there are, you know, you're a young woman sitting in a kind of place of not really any power. No one wants to listen to your decision. So it's kind of a way of saying, oh, maybe this is why this is happening, and then trying to find ways around it. I know Rand and I have discussions a lot about phrasing emails and taking out the I just or I was wondering and the pleasantries that we kind of have been socialized to use to soften the blow of our requests. So it just kind of made me more aware of those things and to try to counter them in my own kind of actions.
Yeah, and I think in the studio setting, it's pretty apparent that males or guys tend to get more time when it comes to critiques and even getting feedback weekly on your projects. And I think that really inadvertently affects how you view your own work and your abilities. And I think it's important to acknowledge that it's not always on you. It could be a structural thing. And I think that's a great thing to remind people.
I think when we go into university, I mean, I think as students, there's always, or like, I think the second you go into any type of institution, there's always like a type of hierarchy and a power dynamic. So I think as students, and especially as young students, we're quite vulnerable. And I don't think that many people realize that or acknowledge that. So I think especially when you're like a first year student, for example, at least in my experience, I really didn't know where I stood in the field. And I really didn't know if I was any good at it and whether I should stay. And because it's such a new environment, I think I would take every little comment or lack of comment from professors or instructors, for example, as a direct implication, I guess, of my worth and like who I am and where I stand in the field. So I think, like Tanvi was saying, when you get less time in a review, or when you get interrupted and asked to, and you know, and they just move on to the next student without actually listening to your presentation, when they kind of dismiss you, that really gets ingrained in you, consciously or subconsciously, and it takes a hit at your self-esteem. Unfortunately, it takes a lot to realize that just because one person doesn't see the value in you doesn't mean that you don't have a space in the field. And I really want people to keep that in mind, especially maybe people who are listening right now who've had similar experiences.
Right. So how does gender affect your pursuits, whether academic, creative, or professional?
For me, it's really shaped what kind of spaces I'm interested in designing, especially within the realm of architecture, because I'm so aware of how gender can impact how we move through space. I'm really interested in creating spaces that kind of break down the barriers we often face as women, just because of the structural, not physical structure, but kind of structural violences that are built into our built environment. So right now I'm working on research in women's shelters and how to best lay them out due to COVID while maintaining those kind of values that, feminist values that many shelters have. So that's kind of shaped the direction that I'm heading towards in my career.
I guess another way that gender, and also just thinking about feminism and equity, has affected my creative or academic pursuits is just noticing it now in workplaces and institutions that I look at. So when I'm researching graduate schools, for example, or when I'm researching places I'd like to work at, I really look at what their faculty looks like, who is in the management, who is, you know, the CEO, like what the ratios are, like is it male dominated and there's one female architect in the firm, or is it more, you know, equitable? Because I think that says a lot about the environment and also just the way that they do things.
And what would you like people to know about your experience as a woman in design, or What are some takeaways you'd like people to have after listening to this little segment of our podcast?
So we've only talked to two professionals so far, but they both had a similar experience in the way they did have to look within themselves and figure out how they viewed themselves as women and what that meant in terms of how they were portraying themselves in the spaces that they were taking up. So one guest lecturer said that she would always phrase her statements as questions, and that's something that I really
relate to.
Yeah, that's something that I really relate to. I think I do that very often. And for me, I just thought that I was being nice. I was being a friendly person, but I realized that it does demean or make less of what I'm trying to say. So the discussions that we have led to a lot of introspection in terms of why I do the things that I do and how they affect my academics, my career.
All right, so to wrap things up, why don't we talk a little bit about how to get involved in the club and what we're up to in the club right now?
Yeah, so we are always taking members. There's a form in our Instagram bio link. It's a Google form. You can just fill out what you're interested in helping with, or if you just want to be on our mailing list, and we'll send you an email with all of our updates. So our Instagram is @makingdifferencetO, so you can find all of our information there. We hold monthly public discussions with professionals, so we touched on those a bit, but it's basically us inviting professionals in either the architecture or art or design field and also academics to just talk to us about their experiences getting to where they are and how maybe gender has impacted how they move through space or what the decisions they made to get where they are were. And anyone is welcome to join those. You don't have to be a student. You don't have to be a U of T student. Really, anyone is welcome to join. We're also selling posters soon for to fundraise for our next semester. So right now, Tanvi actually designed our beautiful poster. They'll be on sale soon, so check out our Instagram for more information there. And we're also always looking for commissioned work to create more posters. So we've set up $50 Gwartzman's gift cards for students who are interested in that to create an illustration for us. And then 10% of the proceeds of the poster sales will go back to you as the artist. And then finally, we also accept, we call it the artist spotlight, but any art that you have as a member of the Daniels community or outside of it that you want to submit to us, and we can put it on our platform. Once a week, we usually do a drop of all of the art. So we're always taking submissions for that, just to uplift our local and global community artists. So everyone is welcome to join, just anyone who wants to engage in these conversations. We'd love to have you.
All right, that's all from Making Difference for today. Follow us on Instagram @MakingDifferenceTO. Thanks for hanging out with us, and we hope to see you soon.
Hi, I'm Louisa Kennett.
And hi, I'm Allison Smith.
And we're two Master of Landscape Architecture students in our third and final year of studies at the Daniels faculty.
On this segment of Women in Design, we will be talking about our experience at Daniels and also catching up with a recent graduate from the program, Elspeth Holland.
One of the great things about our program is that it attracts people from diverse backgrounds. I personally came to the field with an undergrad in biology that was focused on ecology and evolutionary biology. And what intrigued me most about landscape architecture was the ability of this field to address issues at the intersection of social and environmental systems.
While Louise's background is in biology, I come to the program as a mature student with a pretty layered background. I have a Bachelor of Fine Arts in Art History and Sculpture, and after graduating from that, I went on to study fine woodworking at a trade college. I then spent several years living and working as an object maker abroad before beginning my MLA at Daniels. My interest in landscape architecture stems from a fascination with materiality and an understanding that outdoor space in our urban environment is essential for mental and physical well-being.
So Allison and I first met in 2018 during the summer software workshop for incoming grad students. I remember being really nervous coming into that workshop because I had no design background at all, but meeting people like Allison and some other students quickly made me feel at home in the MLA program. And since then, Allison and I have gone through all of the ups and downs of the program side by side.
And there have been a lot of ups and downs, as I'm sure all of you at Daniels are well aware of.
Yeah.
And what's been super essential for me going through this degree has been the support network I've created with a group of peers. There's been some fantastic ladies in my close circle that have helped me get through all the turbulent times.
Yeah, definitely.
And good times.
Kind of gotten to this point in the program without these strong women by my side.
In addition to the presence of many intelligent and capable women in the MLA program, we have also been fortunate to have strong female leadership through numerous professors, the director of the program, and additional support from other women in the field who have all been influential in the shaping of our practice.
Like many professions, landscape architecture has been historically dominated by men, and we are fortunate that in an academic institution such as the University of Toronto, we are seeing such clear female representation.
Yes, absolutely. And we've also been introduced to many female landscape architects, designers, and theorists in our coursework, such as in second year in our landscape theory, as well as in our elective on climate resilient design. We were introduced to many female designers, including Christina Hill, who has become an inspiring figure for both of us.
Hill is currently an associate professor at the Department of Landscape Architecture and Environmental Planning at Berkeley. Her research focuses on adaptive strategies for sea level rise in coastal areas, with a focus on biodiversity, new development approaches, and social justice.
Her emphasis on climate resilience and social equity has been really inspiring for both of us and has become a key resource in the development of our current but separate thesis projects.
We don't do everything together.
Her priority to work in low-income and racialized communities, which are often disproportionately impacted by climate change, has been a big influence on my thesis project, which is looking at resilience to extreme heat in Montreal North.
Her work on dynamic landforms, such as alternative coastal infrastructure strategies that serve not only as flood protection, but also have ecological and recreational benefits, has helped influence my research on the Niagara Escarpment in Hamilton, Ontario, and how it can be a design inspiration for potential air pollution mitigation strategies.
Hill is very interested in context-specific design solutions that consider both local ecology and local communities.
Hill has also been a strong advocate for women in landscape architecture, whose work is often underrepresented in literature, despite their contributions which have shaped the history and the present state of our discipline.
More recently, we've also been introduced to the work of Jane Hutton in our option studio called Mediated Reconstructions. Jane Hutton is a Canadian landscape architect who is currently an assistant professor at the University of Waterloo School of Architecture. She has previously taught at Harvard's GSD as well as at Daniels, and she also received her MLA from U of T. And also she has an undergraduate degree in biology and environmental science, so just like me.
Her research examines the relationship between common building materials and the landscapes they come from, focusing on material flow, labor, and unequal ecological exchange. Her book, Reciprocal Landscapes, Stories of Material Movement, published just last year, traces five common landscape construction materials from New York City back to where they came from. It's the book that I cannot put down. Coming from a very hands-on background in sculpture, shoemaking, and fine woodworking, I find her approach to materiality and material knowledge fascinating. Her work tells hidden stories within the realm of the profession, touching on the everyday materials of our practice, but looking at them from a very introspective lens. In Reciprocal Landscapes, she eloquently opens our eyes to the cause and effect of manipulating landscapes and the global implications of resource extraction.
And this is something that is too often disregarded in the practice of landscape architecture. And in the light of our current climate crisis, it is something we all need to consider as we move forward from students into the professional world.
And speaking of students who have moved into the professional world,
we will now be speaking with Elspeth, who is a recent graduate from the MLA program at Daniels.
Yeah, so we just wanted to say hey and check in on you since I think we last saw you in January or February before the pandemic hit, like almost a year ago.
Yeah.
Probably going through the studio, running to do thesis prep work.
And so, yeah, I remember the day when we all were, you know, sanctioned to go home. We were in class, and then I think I saw a tweet from University of Toronto, and I was just like, oh, there it is. Bye, everyone. Bye forever.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a very, like, abrupt transition.
Yeah.
So what have you been up to since graduation?
I started working in July. I graduated in April, started working in July, so I had a couple weeks of just laying low. Yeah, I've been working since then and not doing a whole lot, I'll be honest with you. And I'm feeling very grateful to be in a comfortable place and a safe place.
And you're working from a firm that's based in Toronto or New York? What did I hear?
Yeah, so I'm working for a firm called Michael Van Valkenburg Associates. They're normally based in Brooklyn and Cambridge, Massachusetts. I'm in Toronto, or Mississauga.
Allison and I, when you were talking earlier, we were just talking about how it's awesome how the MLA program at Daniels attracts people from so many different backgrounds. So we were wondering if you could tell us a little bit about your background and also why you decided to join the MLA program at Daniels.
Prior to Daniels, I studied at the University of Waterloo, and I took a program called Environment and Business. So it's all about, you know, greening businesses and how we can manage and operate businesses in a more sustainable way. It's quite broad, obviously. But then I also took a fine art minor. So at the time, I was kind of dancing around a lot of different stuff. But I kind of always had an interest in design. And what was really great about the program is that it enabled me to take 4 co-op placements. And so one of these co-op placements was at Waterfront Toronto. They had the Toronto's waterfront revitalization. And so I wasn't working on the design team at that point, but I got exposed to, you know, this massive projects they had, including the Lower Donlands. And I'd heard of landscape architecture and I'd known about it, but I hadn't really witnessed or understood the scale at which and the impact that these, you know, kind of works could have, and just really excited me. And so I kind of had it like planted in my mind at that point. And then a couple years later, and a bit of traveling in between, I applied and here I am.
That's great. Yeah. Well, it sounds like the perfect combination of background, like fine art and more like environmental side of things.
Yeah. I mean, like you said, though, what's really cool about my class and the people I've met is that they kind of find their way here from so many different avenues. And, you know, it's really unique that way, and how people use it also, and how people use their knowledge from previous experiences.
Another question we had for you is like how your experience as a woman at Daniels compares to your experience as a woman in the field. Like if you've noticed, because I know at Daniels, we've spoken about this, Louisa and I, earlier in the podcast as well, that there are just there's so much female representation at Daniels. And we're curious if that follows through into the field.
I feel the exact same way. Like at Daniels, you have so much exposure to female leadership. I mean, the director of the program, both current and past, being females, all of the professors. And, you know, I think there was maybe like 7 out of 26 students in my class who were not female. So I guess yours is similar. So I think, like, in my experience, it was always a very comfortable place to, you know, I never felt that I was being looked down upon because I was a woman or I wasn't fitting in or, you know, I feel like we're kind of like riding the coattails of people prior to us, you know, the kind of leaders who paved the way for women to feel they have a place in an educational institution and in the design field. So I had a similar, very positive experience. Although I recognize that, you know, I am a white woman and my experience will not be the same to all women and particularly women of color.
Absolutely.
The second thing is that as a professional, I'm a new graduate, you know, I just entered this field and I think I'm still kind of a student in many ways. And I can't speak for how women's experiences at upper management levels would differ. But I mean, personally, I do have female managers and female leadership at work. I also have like several of my own like personal mentors who've been in my life for a long time, which has been really important for me, you know, just navigating life and professional life. But I know also that it may potentially be more challenging, you know, maybe further along the road or working in other areas of this field that I haven't had much experience in, you know, like I haven't spent much time on a construction site, let's just say, you know, like I've heard or I've recognized that
these are areas where, you know, it may be a little more challenging as a woman to enter that kind of environment and be taken seriously. But I'm very grateful to say that I have had a positive experience both at school and work. And, you know, I'm hopeful that the future will be similar.
Yeah, that's really great to hear and definitely encouraging for us as we, you know, prepare to graduate and starting to look at what those kind of experiences in the field are going to be like.
And also just to make things as equal as possible throughout and to make sure we like fight for that always. And speaking of the future, where do you see yourself in 5 years? You say you're sort of more in the student, you still feel like a student right now, which I can totally understand. We learn a handful of stuff at Daniels, but it's all practice is needed, right?
I mean, again, it's so new, but I do very much feel like I'm just picking up everything I can and like taking in as much as I can. Like, it's hard to think about the future right now, admittedly. Like, not to cop out of this question, but it's difficult.
I respect that answer. It's totally fine.
So currently at work, I've been working on planting design, which, you know, I'm happy to have been given that opportunity. And, you know, I'm like given the chance to start developing my own styles and, you know, coordinating with people. But I do feel, again, like I have a lot to learn. And I'm just hoping to have more opportunities over the next few years, you know, that the kinds of projects I can work on, the kinds of places that I can put my time. So, you know, maybe I'm on more of the 10-year plan, like, you know, I do hope to stay involved with the university. You know, I really enjoy talking to people from Daniels, and I can attest to like how strong the program is. So certainly hope for that to continue. And we'll see, you know, maybe I'll move to New York to be back in the office again.
And I guess on that note, talking about staying in touch with students, I was wondering if you have any advice that you could give to us or other students as we prepare to graduate and start working in the field in the next months and years.
I mean, as I said, I think I can attest to how strong the program is, and like having graduated, you will have the skills necessary to start a job. Like, although there's a lot of technical knowledge that, you know, I'm just like skimming the very surface on this planting stuff, I feel like the general approach to a project and the way of seeing design issues and working with people, these are all skills that you learn in school, and they totally apply. And I can say 100% confidence that I feel, you know, as prepared as other people I'm working with at similar levels who just started working. I think you're in very good hands, and just taking your work seriously and coordinating with your peers and remaining humble to other people's ideas, not getting too discouraged when you receive criticism, because you'll have to do it every day at work. You'll have to present your ideas every day at work. And I think this kind of repetition and gaining more confidence in yourself as you present your ideas and exploring different things, like, these are all like such valuable things. You know, enjoy school and don't have fear, because I really think that anyone graduating from this program is in pretty good shape.
That's great to hear. Yeah, definitely some advice that we could use right now, I think. So great to see you and great to catch up, and best of luck with everything.
Okay.
Thank you so much again. I really appreciate
it. You're welcome. Thanks again.
My name is Jess Misak. I'm an artist and architect in Toronto, a recent graduate of Daniel's master's program. And I'm working right now doing a bit of ceramics on the side and other various activities. And my pronouns are they, them.
Hey, my name is Noor. I am in my thesis year of my master's of architecture at the University of Toronto. I did my undergrad in architectural conservation sustainability engineering, and I am looking forward to a long life journey in architecture.
I'm Jen Tran. I am a not yet graduated and not yet certified landscape architect. My background is in art history and earth science.
I'm Miranda. I will be asking the questions for this segment. I am in my thesis year, my master's of architecture, and my background is in fine arts. in sculpture, and I've just been spending the last 8 months in this basement. So I'm excited to see and talk to people, even virtually. As this was something I sort of mentioned to you all when asking to join this segment, is sort of my discomfort with the category of women in design. So what are your thoughts on this distinction? Is this something you identify with or do you not identify with, or think it's kind of a weird category to be put in?
I actually do see it as a beneficial identifier in some respect. So when we're thinking of architecture and landscape architecture as art and practice, it of course necessarily reflects the experience and understanding of the designer. So I think in some ways, acknowledging the fact that I am a woman of color, I think that is relevant to my design practice and my philosophy and understanding. So I do see some use of it as that sort of framing device for understanding.
To some extent, this term, it's weird because not just in architecture or in design, but anytime they want to diversify, they always like call it like women in engineering or women in design or women in whatever. And it's a pretty interesting identification, I could say, because you never see men in design or you never see men in fashion or men in dancing. You don't see that type of identification when it's, even when it's a feminine or let's say female majority field of some sort. So let's say ballet or dance like that. A man dancer or a male of that like opposite identification. So I do find that identification a little bit, not misleading, but unfortunate. But at the same time, I do recognize the fact that it pushes towards equality and creating more diversity and giving opportunities for women out there in all the different various fields that are currently male dominated. So I recognize its advantages, but I mean, that is something Zaha Hadid used to mention, saying, I'm not a woman architect, I'm an architect. And I think it's very important to understand that the reason for that isn't to identify women in design or architecture, but it's just to open the doors for more to come in. But they're all going to be called architect doesn't identify them in the long term.
Firstly, I guess I would say that I have like an immediate kind of like visceral feeling to the phrase woman in architecture. To me, it doesn't really encompass even just the surface level of equity issues or gender issues. I agree, like I think often when we see these tropes of a form on women in architecture or something in design or women in design, it is used as a kind of like band-aid surface level discussion about equity and ignores the bulk and the kind of roots of many of these issues. For example, it doesn't always address racism or classism or transphobia especially. And so for me, it feels like almost a bit of a dated way to talk about equality and equity and access for professional life in design.
The issues of using the identifier of women in architecture as like a form of tokenism, I think, is really prevalent. And you're right, it's not a monolithic experience of womanhood. And it's very clear that there is a huge amount of intersectionality that is ignored.
Yeah, I think that was something that like I initially like was kind of brought up. My sister always says this as a lawyer. She said when she's in an interview and she starts asking about the diversity within their firm and they start talking about how many women they employ, it's like, well, hiring white women isn't really diverse. Like women make up a significant portion of our population. That's not really that diverse. It's just the other side of things. So I think when we have these discussions of like women in design, especially when I am a white woman, and I feel like so predominantly it's like white women are the focus of these conversations, it really ignores larger issues and like stifles other conversations that would be more beneficial to be had other than just like celebrating white women, which I feel like when we talk about women in design a lot, I've been to a lot of events and that's where I'm excited to talk about these things, and then I'm let down by the lack of actual diversity that is happening within them. What barriers do you think affect your designing career, and do you think the design field is gendered in a certain way that is like preventing people from easily accessing jobs, internships, and like the respect that they deserve within their field?
To me, yes, it is a very gendered field. And I will offer kind of a recent story of mine where a couple months ago, I went to sign up as an intern architect with OAA because I've been working and I had a mentor set and I was, you know, prepared to dish out the hundreds of dollars to sign up, which in itself is a barrier. I'd done all my graduate paperwork and I open up the registration and I'm stumped at the scroll down options of male or female. And so legally, like literally legally in Ontario, you cannot register as a genderqueer or gender nonconforming or a gender neutral person. You must choose the male or female option. And it leaves me with the question is, do I register as female, which Canada offers a gender neutral option on your passport and your ID, which is something that I've been transitioning into. So do I contradict this and register as a female architect, or do I just not register? And so I haven't registered, and I'm hoping that I can kind of convince some people to change this. But, you know, it's just one of the many moments where I've had a kind of aha moment, like, no, this is something stopping me from being my true self, expressing my true identity in a profession and academic setting versus how I behave outside of this setting and the circles that I actually, communities I actually participate with.
And the amount of like actual labor you have to go into like do these things every day. Like now you have to email somebody to let them know like, hey, can we do this? And then it's probably going to be a few months of going back and forth, a lot of stress just going into getting registered where it seems sort of so outdated. Like why do they even need to have that information? Like so many other governmental processes don't. Like what does it matter to a certain extent?
And I think another thing is it reflects, say you had a project that targeted the LGBTQ community, or you know, you were a trans person seeking out an architect and might want some type of specific lens on spaces that's a queer lens. You cannot look up in the OAA registry for a queer person. We get into kind of semantics or issues where maybe you shouldn't be able to just identify all queer people on a list, an institutional list. But it makes it extremely difficult to connect as an architect or as a designer if you can't hold your identity at the forefront of your existence in the field.
It should never be that way. There should never be something that would stop someone from registering, doing the basics at the start of the journey of architecture. This is literally the start. This is the push. So it should never be hard or inaccessible or targeted and gendered and asked about. And, you know, you see all those questions that they even go into more detail about what do you identify as in gender, but also like your background and who you're attracted to and things like that. And I see why institutions like bigger ones ask for these questions, because they are trying to diversify. It already puts a person in a bubble the moment they ask these questions, because you already feel like you're the different one going in. There's always that second thought of, okay, well, did they look at my work because I work well, or did they look at it because I was a woman? You know, things like that, or because I was from like a Middle Eastern background or something like that, because I'm a parent Muslim. There's all of those questions that I kept asking myself even now when I was applying for jobs. It's like, what do they really see? And I understand like they don't know at the beginning, but it's so easy to know. Like we have social media, one search will show them who we are, especially if you're, you know, someone on social media. And it's sad to say, but our profession is very extremely gendered, to the extent where you see a lot of female, at least right now, and like not just females, like a mix of diversity in schools as a body of students, maybe not faculty, but students. And then where are they after? Where is everyone? Why do they never continue and move forward? It's because of these things that people need to go through that makes it so much harder. And I remember talking to one of the profs that were female about this, and she said, like you need to work really extremely hard to get to that directorship level. And it's just sad that a woman or a minority needs to work 10,000 times where a man, let's say a white man, can easily get to in quarter the effort. I think this is where the problem starts. It doesn't help when the wages are different. It doesn't help when there's no equity. When you go to construction sites and they're making fun of a female engineer or architect, and it just doesn't help when you're just identified by things that are all made by society. Like they're not even true identification of anything. I can make the same work as whatever gender. It's not about the gender. It's about the effort and the work.
A lot of the times, this focus on what a person's work is also doesn't give the right level of attention to the factors that result in the level of work that they put out. Mm-hmm. So things like the privilege that they are given with wealth, support,
education, resources, all of these things, of course, affect someone's output and eventually their opportunities as well. So I guess that's something that should be more focused on. You were also speaking about women having to work harder in the field. And this idea of women in positions of power is, I think, something that is also completely lacking. There's so few visible minorities or women in positions of power within the majority of the big firms in architecture and landscape. And that's a systemic thing that needs to not only change with recruitment, but also the factors that lead to the production of work.
The way that the academic setting is set up and the pressures associated with it also transfer often to the kind of egotistical and social pressures within offices and firms. You know, notably and often sometimes shockingly, I think to many people, architects and landscape architects don't really get paid time off. They often don't get benefits. There's a real lack of social support within the industry while you're doing intense overtime. And all of this also reflects back down onto academia. You're expected to pull these late nights. You're expected to not work while studying or taking part in design, and it disenfranchises people from academia and from the profession who have other responsibilities, who might have kids, who might already have struggles of, you know, wealth or other kind of institutional, social, socioeconomic struggles. So it's all kind of interconnected within this.
It definitely takes away a lot from our well-being and health. And I think that should also be tackled, like, as one of the main points to identify why are some people, like, why can't they move forward with it? Why aren't they using their education, their passion, and building their dreams? Why are they running away into things they also regret? It's because of those points that Jess mentioned. And it's very important to recognize them and change all the way down from education level up to institutional level, for sure.
I saw a meme today about the richest architects in the world, and they're all men, of course, but not all of them are white necessarily, but predominantly white. And it reflects also onto like another version of kind of trickling down, where you see this play out in, you know, non-Stark Tech firms. You see it play out in academia. There is a wealth disparity within pay, but there just are so many barriers in architecture to becoming an actual architect that are based on financial and the ability to socially mobilize. And if you are someone who has been kind of disenfranchised socially, you know, possibly a woman, but attached also to many other equity issues, it just increases the barriers for you to be able to achieve a stamp, to be able to be in a position where you're actually making substantial decisions about spaces in our city that will shape people's lives and that people will then experience. And this, again, relates to representation. You know, when we study architects, we often get a repetitive series of architects in architectural history. You know, we all have sat through 50 lectures about Le Corbusier. And, you know, maybe once you may hear about Lena Bobardi, or, you know, like every once in a while they pepper in a female architect and they usually male prof, you know, it looks a little smug and, you know, feels good about their, you know, effort and diversity. And it needs to be a more disruptive action. It needs to be a more deliberate action within faculties and within the discipline. People need to be given, or they need to be able to take opportunities without barriers, especially financial barriers.
There's two sort of architecture positions where I've taken the jobs, expecting to be paid as my fellow male colleagues were being paid. And I wasn't. They were actually not going to pay me, which just seemed quite absurd. And I was talking about this, and I did end up getting paid in the end. I kind of was like, hey, like, I'm doing the same work, blah, blah, blah. Like, why? Like, this is kind of the agreement that we've set into. Like, albeit they were both verbal agreements, they weren't contracts or anything like that, but we did have an agreement put in place that I was to be paid. And I was talking about this with a male colleague of mine who's a white guy, and he's like, what? I've never not been paid for a job. I was like, really? I'm like, you've never? I like had the issue where somebody was like, just like, nah, I don't think you're worth as much as you think you are. And I feel like it's really takes a toll on your like self-esteem within the field, to constantly have to really advocate for yourself to fight this wage gap. And it's exhausting at times to fight for this a wage gap that a lot of people don't think doesn't exist.
Yeah, and we're not even taught to know our rights, like even from the beginning. Like when we go to school, they should tell us, do not, like you're a master's student at one of the top schools in the world, do not accept non-paid internship, no matter the situation. Because we have to be told those things right to our faces, because when we don't, we start to second guess ourselves and we start to think, oh no, we need the internship, we need that experience. But listen, if we don't know our worth, that experience means pretty much nothing. It's just they're using you pretty much. And it's okay to be told that. It hurts to hear, but honestly, if we don't hear it, we'll never know. And it's just so hard to know when you're starting your career, when you're starting something that is complex and hard, and there's just so much on your plate. You've barely had enough sleep. And we live in Toronto, one of the most expensive cities too. So we should be appreciated for the work. We should be paid like at least the equal. That should not even be a question, right? Like, so the fact that so many of my friends told me that same, like almost a similar story of them working for someone and they didn't end up paying them eventually. And it makes me so angry like that. It's just, that just shows how unethical this profession can be, or how they've normalized that unethical behavior, because it's never normal. It's, you're taking a very strong master's students. Like, you should be paid even more than what you think you need or what you are going to take. But we don't recognize that because we're not told that. If on the first day of school, they told us, listen, you guys need to be paid, need to make sure you're paid equally kind of thing, and need to speak up equally on even for males and all genders and all ethnicities, like, you know, it's something that we all need to hear, and we don't get that in education.
Do you think the Daniels as a faculty understands these barriers and are working towards dissampling them? I think this is at a moment where I think Daniels is having hopefully shifting perspectives on these types of topics and issues, where hopefully we are being heard as students bringing up these concerns in our faculty.
Often I find this is an extremely difficult question for me, because there are many, many aspects of my 8 years at U of T and at Daniels that I really have adored. But it's difficult for me to sit with criticism and to unload criticism on an institution that I also have kind of surely been complacent with. You know, for 8 years I have worked within, and there's been a lot of reflection during this for myself on ways that I've also kind of contributed and perpetuated issues of equity within Daniels. So I will say that first off. But I have found it, you know, lacking in many aspects, and I'll speak specifically sometimes to queer aspects. But I recently, I completed my thesis on queer communal spaces, and specifically on spaces where the queer body could relax, which in my case were bathhouses. And, you know, there was always a kind of overload or overhanded question of, first off, why queer? You know, why these bodies? It came up in every single one of my critiques. And it was something that at a certain point my advisor was prepping me on. You know, you need to have a kind of like 10-minute, you know, like the first half of your presentation needs to get people to not feel off-put by raising just the topic of queer people and queer bodies. And you have to get them to believe that it's not, you know, that homophobia and transphobia still exists. And that it eventually leads into where, you know, despite having some supportive figures, there was no representation. There was nobody in the entire faculty I could turn to, except for one brand new member, to talk about this without having to start with the kind of preamble of, this is what the word queer means, or start with a preamble of, I don't mean to offend you by not including you in this project, but it's not for your community.
It's for my community.
Yeah, and, you know, there were moments where we would have members who were either faculty or invited guest critics on my panel, and I would have to sit through things like, you know, a critic saying, oh, you know what, actually, I think I do understand this project. Gay men are much more social than regular men, so this might work. Or, you know, I had so many guest critics literally stop and say, wait, can you say the word queer now? And just like absurd things like this. And it's not that, you know, it's aggressions like these that just somehow elevated my project, which to me was supposed to be an academic, thoroughly researched design project that other people have touched on, that I wanted to discuss for its merits of design, its social implications, its poetry. But instead, I was having to deal with so much kind of emotional armor and emotional conversations about, you know, the relevance of queerness in design. It was perpetuated by many people on the faculty. You know, I adore my advisor, and she was very supportive for me, but she'd never stop any of these sentences. You know, once another guest critic said, well, I don't think we could, to that one comment about the gays, I don't think we could just say that about all gay men. And it was truly frustrating to me. You know, I never really came out officially as genderqueer at Daniels when I was in it. There were people who knew, but I never really said it until my thesis review. And that was for a very, very apparent reason. And it wasn't intentional necessarily by everyone, but it was perpetuated. And there was a protection amongst people who made these missteps that could have easily been avoided and could have been a case for a lot of reconciliation for myself and for other queer people. I also want to say that my cohort in particular, only a couple people dropped out, and overwhelmingly those people were queer or genderqueer. And I'm not to say that that was the whole encompass of things, but I also experienced a lot of situations with my peers who were extremely transphobic and extremely homophobic. You know, I can list it off. There was one of my peers kept a copy of Mein Kampf at his desk, and a prof never said anything. Why do you need, you know, the Nazi Bible at your desk in architecture school? Why are people sharing Jordan Peterson videos around and trying to campaign each other within the cohort to start watching it and believing in it? Why are you sharing books of it and then picking fights with me because you know that I'm queer and I'm the person to pick a fight with it until I cry type of thing? You know, it's just, I did my undergrad very attached to University College, which was the first college to introduce women at U of T, and it's by far the most kind of gender diverse college. It has the sexual diversity studies faculty within it. And it was just, I feel like when I left that world and entered Daniels officially as my master's, I felt like I was bursting a bubble. I really hope that there's a future for it to change. And I think that some of this is starting with our conversations.
Those things are always apparent, and it's harder to speak up when you're going through it. I think the faculty kept asking when I was going through my things, like, okay, you need to write a report about it. Well, when you're being treated like someone who should never be treated like that, or if you're being treated differently because of what you're wearing or what you're attracted to or whatever, then you really don't feel like writing it on paper because it really makes it even more true. And I think what I think the faculty did wrong is when I was voicing what I was going through, when my friends went to them to voice what I was going through, and Miranda, I think you were there when some of those things happened, or I was one of the, like, I came and talked to you about it, but there were things, you know, there were profs that told me things during reviews that no one else in my group heard, things like, you don't belong here, and things like, a master's student should never do something like that. And I was a first year student coming from an engineering background. You know, like, it really solely felt like I was being targeted as an apparent Muslim, as an apparent, you know, minority. And I think it's hard not to think of it that way because there was no other explanation. My work was very similar to my peers. And I think part of what the faculty is doing It's trying. I'm not going to say it's not, but it's not trying enough to make it comfortable, a comfortable space. It's sad because even as Joseph said, like being the diversity and equity officer really gives you another sight. And for me, it was very, very hard because I was fighting just before the Black Lives Matter movement. All the points that were that came across during that movement, no one was listening to me. They were mocking me. I was talking to them about the woman, diversifying the studio and adding more women, but also Black women, Black males, you know, Black everyone. I was fighting for the LGBTQ. I was trying so hard. And what I was getting back is, Noor, it's all in your head. Or, Noor, you're the only person that keeps coming to us telling us you heard this. Why isn't anybody else saying that? And I'm like, if one person came to you, told you something, it doesn't make it any less important, or it doesn't make it any less true. It's just, it was that one person that had the guts to say it at that time. And now that people are speaking up, Black Lives Matter movement happened, and I'm thankful for that because it really needed to happen for the school to start acting. And it didn't before, to be honest. And I'm upset to say that it didn't work as hard. And now that it is, honestly, I don't think that there should be an extreme movement every time for someone to be heard, for someone to be treated the same, for someone to come out as who they want to be or who they are. So I think it's very important for the school to realize that if someone comes and tells you there's something wrong with that, or I'm not feeling comfortable being myself because of a certain faculty member or a certain, like, everyone, then the school should think it's enough for them to take action. It should not always be a report that you're another case or you're a thing. We're humans. We have emotions, we have feelings, and those should be taken into consideration. I get the institution level. I get that people need to, you know, maybe someone else can if the person who's going through it can't at that time. And another point just mentioned was that, you know, it would happen during crit and no one would say something back, or no one would stand up for that wrong thing that was that happened. At my crit, when I had that situation happen, when the person was targeting me personally, the other profs were looking at me like, I'm sorry, but couldn't say it. None of them stopped the other person. One of them actually joined and started saying other things. I think the faculty should be asked to speak up about things like that and should always have the students back, because if we're not comfortable there, then we'll never be a family. We'll never be comfortable as a whole school, as a society.
Maybe looking for more diversity. That's almost the bare minimum of what the faculty can be doing, because that doesn't really address the systemic barriers that preclude equal representation. So I think pursuing measures that can assist students or that can assist in recruiting students from varying backgrounds is something that should be also strengthened within the faculty.
But the faculty itself has a kind of way of protecting and a way of discouraging people from speaking up about these issues of equity and inequality. And it's not always men who do it. Often it's kind of an internalized sexism or internalized racism. I haven't seen internalized homophobia because there hasn't been a lot of, you know, homophobic. Well, no, there's been a lot of homophobic. Anyways, there's not a lot of queers. But what I meant to say was, you know, there were many things that I was called in the school. Like, a prof saw me putting up a poster about diversity and equity issue, or I think it was a forum or something like that, and she started calling me Miss Politics. And for 2 years, I don't think she learned my name. She just said, oh, Miss Politics, you've always got something to say. Little things like that, or not speaking up, not shutting down issues when they happen and then perpetuating them. I will put the past dean and the faculty on blast for this one, but when I was the diversity and equity officer, I was invited to a 2-hour long meeting about the new tenure hires that happened a couple of years ago. And it was a very interesting meeting. I was among the entire diversity and equity faculty group, which is about, you know, a handful of 4 people or so, and there were other people in the room, but the dean was facing me the entire time as the person who would criticize him. And there was a presentation that was made, and extremely detailed, extremely nicely presented. They had beautiful infographics, and the entire presentation was about how they chose the new tenure hires, what the breakdown of people they interviewed were, who made it through the stages, and it was all broken down by gender. Once in a while, there was like a slight indication of whether a person was white or non-white. These were the breakdowns, and it took 2 hours to present. And at the end of it, after, you know, convincing me that they had gone to halfway of the whole process with equal representation of men and women, in the end, they had to choose these men, these three men, because they were just so much better than anyone else they had interviewed, and they just couldn't turn them up. And I sat there and I had to be polite and say, well, firstly, your breakdown only acknowledges women versus men. They kept saying the word woman versus men, which is not what the issue is about at all. You know, it's not women versus men. It's a lot more complicated nuance than that. I also said, you have to look at the breakdown of also who these people are that you're hiring and who you deem as qualified. And they all come from Harvard. They all come from Princeton. They're all Ivy League graduates. Extremely privileged people, which automatically disadvantages a huge, huge number of people who would otherwise be fantastic candidates. The faculty needs to address their hiring process in a different way. And it's not about metrics and sitting down and saying, well, we interviewed an exact equal amount of women and men. It's about interviewing absolutely diverse people, and that includes their background, that includes valuing things above accomplishments that are much, much easier for certain people to achieve.
Yeah, that's absolutely a paradox. If the school doesn't use its power as a huge institution to foster these new conversations with a more diverse set of faculty, speakers, and staff, how are they going to expect these same voices to eventually come back to them and present some level of diversity and progress for them?
These issues and these conversations have been going on for a long time, and it's interesting to me that they are somewhat being addressed right now. Whether that becomes apparent in any real structure, I'm not entirely sure that, you know, a podcast is the solution.
It feels like it's like every 20 years or so. Everybody like gets their pitchfork out and they're like, okay, let's go battle some injustices in the world, and then we all kind of like go to sleep on it, and like it falls on deaf ears. What do you think the future of gender equity and diversity is in the design field? I feel really hopeful at this moment, but also it's bittersweet in a certain sense. Like, is anything gonna actually happen? And I would agree, like, will this podcast actually do anything? I think there's like this effort of like, well, you just gotta keep trying and keep talking about it, because even if it is falling on deaf ears, I don't know anything else that I can do than just keep talking about it.
Power of speech is huge, and I think that is what I struggled with as part of the diversity and equity officer, is I was alone. Like, they wanted so many voices, and so we're giving them the voices they want now. So it's like we're telling them, okay, what's your excuse now, you know? Like, and part of it is that, like, when people hear others' experiences and how it was, and hopefully how it's different in the future in the better way, then it just motivates the whole society as a whole to change. And I can see how it's even like within UFT, like there are faculties where they're so good at diversity and equity, and they're like, they've tried so hard during the years that their faculty body, but also student body, is like very diverse. It's not like there's no hope. It's just that we're going at a really, really slow pace. It's 2021 almost. Like, come on, people are capable of what they're doing. Nothing should, we shouldn't discriminate upon a person like that. As students, what we can do is speak up about it always and try and show where these wrongs are, but also not take over the faculty in a way, because I felt like the mural that was put, for example, on the, like, the facade of our school, it was a great initiative out of the students, but it really feels, to someone who doesn't know the history behind it or who did it, if it looks from the outside like, oh, hey, good job, faculty, you guys really care, but really it's the student who did it. It's important to recognize that there's a huge gap between where the students want to be and where the faculty is. And I think that that is where the communication needs to happen. I think throughout the whole years, we've seen how the student bodies have really found it hard to get in contact or into meetings where faculty is usually dominating the talk, or the dean specifically. So it really just, it needs to happen from there. And it's a lot hopeful because we do see our student peers. I was really frustrated, to be honest, at some point last year, because there were students that were against me talking about how some profs are treating them as male students better than they're treating me during a crit, for the sole reason of they're being liked more for some reason. And I was really shocked by how even sometimes our own colleagues and friends who we share memories with and like we're really close are the ones sometimes who might still be taking those thoughts of not treating people equally from faculty, like from others, and applying it even to their lives. So if you see your friend who's still very young, who's the next big architect, discriminating upon their own friends, then you see how much of a problem that becomes. The moment like the students are in it too, then that's a problem. And I think that is what I was trying to really talk about, and I couldn't enough, because it's really hard to criticize your own friends, but also criticize your own faculty. It becomes like you're criticizing your family. It's important to do, but it's harder. And this is why speaking up is really, really important, because if we don't speak up, then we might be swooped into something that is just a big mess.
The creation of spaces for these conversations and the ability for the faculty to understand and act upon these new requests without looking at it as a slight on the authority of the institution is something that really needs to be championed, because as long as students are forced to express their concerns and their desires within these systems that are historically meant to only bolster the kind of image of the faculty, nothing will be done.
I'll be completely honest, I've been quite disillusioned with what progress means within institutions, and specifically within Daniels. I've been at it for a long time, and specifically I can say that I've seen reports that Daniels has put out about, look, we've hired this percentage more women, we've done it. You know, we're almost at equal women. If you count the visual studies program and the forestry program, we're almost there. Where we finished. I will say, this is not the future. You know, there needs to be more heart and more care put into what the idea and what the concepts are that people are conveying to you, and also try to actually imagine what that might feel like, what the, you know, what the bright vision of an equitable, of a diverse body of thought and voices and people may be, and where they feel comfortable. And, you know, for me, looking at the future, like, time has dissolved in COVID, so I can't really imagine our profession's future necessarily. Like, there's so much to be changed on so many levels, and fortunately a lot of that is tied to, you know, architecture is a slave to capitalism. You know, it's meant to make money, and diverse opinions don't always do that. Voice for voice and for the art of different voices doesn't always fulfill that need. And I could talk about what my feelings are right now and what I feel determined about what progress for me is like, and that's a kind of a bullish desire to hold on to community, to trust in people and trust in each other, and create action and voice together. To me, it's not about the egotistical vision of an architect to create beautiful space. It's, for me, it's about valuing humbleness, valuing personal social growth through the vessel of space, through the vessel of design. I think about the work that the Encampment Support Network is doing, or Keep Your Rent Toronto. And, you know, many of the recent graduates have been compelled in COVID to do work with them. And these are gatherings of people in the community out there making real change to try to support equity within Toronto, within the city, and within Canada and worldwide. And that, to me, is the future. It's not about the metrics. Not about the infographics. It's not about achieving, you know, half women, half men in the faculty. It's truly not. It has to be a more humble and heartfelt approach to equity.
I think it's interesting because I think a lot of our faculty would agree with the statements that you're saying. A lot of the architecture field would agree with what you're saying, but then they're going off and doing the complete opposite, especially when it comes to like sensitive community, giving voice, all those ideas, like inherently we're drawn to them, but it's like, why are we actually executing those on large scales? Do we actually have the means to execute those? Is where I feel like there's a big falling like between the sort of like ideologies and the actual practice itself that I think needs to be held accountable to. Like, we can't just be talking about all these things and then just going and building some condos once we graduate and then be like, yeah, forget all that funny stuff you learned in school.
Yeah, it's like, it's super easy to build a condo and like enjoy the work of aestheticizing capitalism when you treat architecture as something only aesthetic and separate from identity and political understanding. Like, it's a privilege to be able to think of architecture as an art in vacuum.
As someone who has recently entered the profession, you know, I've been working at a firm for a while. I want to remind people that even when you're, if you don't believe that the opportunity to enact social change exists within the firms that are out there or that are hiring, that that's not the end of the road for you. You know, you may have to accept something to continue and to get a bit of movement and power, but there's so much organizing to be done and there's so many things happening. There's a huge movement right now in Toronto and Ontario to create an architecture student or an architecture union. You know, there's so many things happening, and sometimes you may need to stand up in your profession and say, I'm not going to take this opportunity because that it doesn't align with my values. And sometimes you need to seek out actions for those values outside. And, you know, that's certainly something that I remind myself of all the time, because I can always be doing better as well.
Yeah, I was just going to say thank you to everybody. I know this is like one of the things that is very difficult to talk about and is exhausting to talk about and is very vulnerable to talk about as well. But I just want to thank you all for coming out and joining. And I appreciate all of your perspectives on this.
All right, well, that is all we have for you today. It was so wonderful to listen to these powerful voices within the Daniels community and share in solidarity our experiences as feminized designers. I think this podcast series is a great start in getting these much needed discussions of equity going within the faculty, and I'm grateful to have a voice in it. The music in this podcast includes Circus by Bonobo, Ori's Escape and Transparent, Geiji's Passion Fruit and Waking Up Down, Like This by Park Hye-jin, Snowblind by Tanya Tagak, and Grimes, Devin, and Vanessa. Thank you to everyone who worked on a segment, as well as Erica Ulrich, who helped to edit, and Mark Bennett, who contributed to the musical selection. As well, I would like to thank our faculty coordinators, Jay Pooley and Peter Seeley, for making this space possible. And thank you for tuning in today.